got a text a short while ago from a good friend whose name I won't mention, but I can't resist at this point. And the text said, "It's good when your old boss becomes your warm-up act." So thank you, David Yalka. Good work. It's dangerous to send me texts. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. It's been just an extraordinary 2 days. We've been extremely gratified at the number of people both who came out to hear our presentations yesterday in the Five Towns and here in Teaneck today. Really hundreds and hundreds of people. And we're particularly excited as a group to be able to share the work that we do with regarding based in work generally and the work we do at the Bethden of America and our overall objective of promoting Jewish justice. A lot of the presentations I believe you've already heard today really focus on a lot of the details of the work that we do, halachic implications, legal implications. I hope to continue some of that in this last presentation, but I'd like to take it ever so gently into a little bit of a values conversation. First of all, this is for ethics credit. And second of all, I think it's important that when we talk about Bethden work, when we talk about our based in obligations of work, it's not simply that we speak about it in terms of our halachic requirements, but also the values we're trying to achieve, the community that we're trying to build. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to try and talk a little bit about Jewish justice by talking a little bit about the role of lawyers in Bethden and the role of lawyers generally under Jewish law. And hopefully we can have a conversation about really what's ultimately a question of institutional design. What kind of legal system is halacha trying to build? And it seems the most appropriate way for me to do that is to start with some lawyer jokes. Does anybody mind lawyer jokes? No targets here. I can't help it. My son really likes this part. What do you call a smiling, courteous person at a bar association convention? Anybody?
Caterer.
Do you have my script? The caterer. The video guy said I need to repeat what the audience says. The caterer, that's right. That's good. Are you a lawyer? That's why you know. Okay. Are you a caterer? Okay. Okay, I'm gonna do another one. What's the difference between a lawyer and a liar? The pronunciation. Okay, but I'm ching. Okay. What do I tell these? I tell these to capture the intuition I suspect lots of us all know quite well. Lawyers often don't have a great reputation. People see them as obfuscating, undermining, a variety of things that somehow impede justice as opposed to promote justice. And I would say Jews are often viewed as, well, the lawyers are Jews. And let me tell you what I mean by this. I have a good friend. He allows me to tell this story. I assume the quid pro quo in telling the story is that I advertise for him. So his name is Lou Shapiro, or Louis Shapiro, fantastic criminal attorney in Los Angeles, Whenever something comes up in that area, he's the guy I go to. So if you're in Los Angeles, you need a criminal attorney, not a criminal attorney, but a criminal law attorney, call Louis Shapiro. Okay. Louis Shapiro in college went by the name Lou Shap. I don't know why. But when I got to Los Angeles, Lou had moved out there, and he started calling himself again Louis Shapiro. And we for a couple of years, we carpooled. Our kids go to the same school. And one day I said to him, "Lou, why'd you go back from Lou Shap to Louis Shapiro?" And he says to me, "Avi, here's the story. I spend a lot of my time in prisons. That's where my clients are often, which is why they need my services." And he says, the most important thing in terms of getting clients while I'm in a prison, every single person in there, you know what they want? They want a Jewish lawyer. And so now I go by Louis Shapiro. Now, he didn't mean it as a joke. It was just the truth. And this is the association of Jews as lawyers, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, there are a lot of lawyer jokes out there, enough that people seem to know the punchlines before I even tell them. And so what I want to think about a little bit is, given kind of the perception of lawyers and also the fact that there are there's also this perception that there are many Jews as lawyers, so what's the Torah's view of lawyers? You can see that there's like a little bit of tension here. We ultimately aspire to promote justice, not inhibit justice. How does halacha view this? And what I want to show you through the process of analyzing the role of lawyers or the challenge of being a lawyer from the perspective of halacha is really a question about how do we use kind of the different chess pieces on the adjudicative board to figure out how to ultimately promote the type of justice system halacha would like us to have. So if you'll indulge me, and hopefully you have source sheets in front of you, I'm going to make frequent reference to them, so feel free to pull them out or not. Okay, so I'd like to start our conversation. I have it as, I don't have your booklet, I just have source one of my, page one of my source sheets, source number one, which is a different page number for you. The Mishnah and Maseches Avos that initially appears to address this question. So here we have Pirkei Avos, Perek Aleph Mishnah Ches. Join me for a little read. Oh, you're going to give me this one. Okay, great. Well, this is great. This is amazing. It looks just like mine. Yehuda ben Tabai, Shimon ben Shetach, Kiblu Mehem. This, again, following the structure of Pirkei Avos. It's passed down from generation to generation. Yehuda ben Tabai, Omer, Al Taas Atzmecha Ke'orchei Hadayanim. Don't make yourself like, let's not translate it for now, Orchei Hadayanim. Anybody want to give it a whirl? Don't tell me what modern Hebrew is quite yet. How would you translate Orchei Hadayanim? Anybody? This is going to be a lot of audience participation. The whole, like, chilling out in the seat, it ain't going to work anymore. I'm going to start cold advisor. Calling. What?
Advisor.
How did you get to advisor? Or chei hadayanin? What does la'aroth mean? Anybody? Set, arrange, good. Dayanin? Okay, good. So we have an arranger of judges. That's maybe the best translation. Now, of course, we're all colored by the fact that an oreth din in modern Hebrew is a lawyer. So we think of oreth din as, oh, yeah, sure, we know that's a lawyer. But if you actually just look at the Mishnah in and of itself, orchei hadayanin is an arranger of judges, and it's ambiguous to some extent. We'll see the Rishonim dispute what it might mean. It's ambiguous inherently as to what the terminology might mean. So let's take a pause on that first phrase. There are two other clauses in the Mishnah. Uchsheyu balei dinin omdim lifanecha, and when the litigants are standing before you, yu b'einecha kirushaim, they should be like wicked people before you. Who's you in that sentence? Okay, good. Sounds like judges, right? Litigants are before you. It sounds like clause number two of the Mishnah is referring to, or the object of the obligation, or the instruction, is a judge. Let's look at the third one. Uchsheniftar milfanecha yiyu beinecha kizakayin kshekiblo aleim esadin. And when they leave your courtroom, having accepted the judgment, regard them as equally righteous. Clause number three is who's the object, or who's being spoken to? Judges. Okay, so before we even warm up on this Mishnah, let's think about it for a second. Clause number two, clause number three appear to be speaking to judges. Clause number one, we've already noted, is somewhat ambiguous. Now, if we take the approach that our instinct is pushing us, that it refers to lawyers, the Mishnah is like a little bit clunky. Could be. That's right. Yeah, I think the translation may be mine. Sorry about that. In any event, I hope I didn't prejudge the issue. I guess that's also a joke in my translation. But you can see how we have an ambiguous phrase and then two phrases that appear to be referring to judges. And so maybe our instinct to think that clause number one refers to lawyers, maybe it doesn't. But if clause number one refers to kind of third parties and how they should act, so the Mishnah seems to be speaking to two sets of people. Not like inherently problematic, but as we start looking at the Rishonim and we see maybe interpretations of the first clause that we won't think of as intuitive, the structure of the Mishnah is also going to start nudging some of the Rishonim in a direction that we might not anticipate. Now that I've said that at the outset, let's take a look at page number 40 or 2, depending on your preferred way of counting. Okay, good. So we've got page number two. We've got two mefarshim here, excerpted somewhat, trying to address the question of what we might mean by orchei hadayanim. So let's take the Rambam and the Perush HaMishnah. So the Rambam says as follows: Orchei hadayanim heim anashim halomdim et hahitdainut kidei sheyu murshim livnei adam bedineihem. These are the men who train to make claims so that they can have power of attorney on behalf of people in their civil disputes. V'heim misharim she'elot, im yomar hashofet kach, tiyat shuvato bekach, v'im yitan bal hadin bekach, tiyat shuvah kach. If the judge asks such, respond with such. If your opposing party claims such, respond with such. They provide direction as to how to respond to the various types of questions that might come up in the course of litigation. It says if they're arranging the judges and the litigants before them. Ulafikach, therefore, kraum orchei hadayanim. Therefore, we call them orchei hadayanim because they are arranging the various parties before them. Ki iluhim archu hadayanim lifneihem, as if they arrange the judges before them. V'he's here, and the Mishnah warns us, mihidamot lahem, to be like them. Ritzono lomar, sheyolmad echad mibale hadin ta'ana shetov ilehu, that you'll teach one of the litigants an argument that will help him, v'yomar lo, and you'll say to him, again, mimicking the words before, amor kach, o hakcheshbo finzeh, say this, or contradict, or find a counter-argument along the following lines, v'afilu yada, and this is the extraordinary part of the Rambam, please keep this in mind throughout our conversation here today, v'afilu yada shehu ashuk, and even if this third party, who is kind of has a desire or an instinct to help one of the parties because that a party is oppressed in some way, u'sheba'aldino toin alav b'sheker l'fi hechra hasvara, and the opposing party is making some sort of claim that is clearly, from the third party can tell merely by the content of the claims, he knows that it's a lie. And the person who has this liar, he's dealing with the liar as a litigant, and you have this third party who knows that this poor fellow who's being oppressed is dealing with the liar, still the Rambam says, Ein mutar lo lulamdo tana shetatzilehu b'shum panim. He still may not teach him any type of claim that will save him in any which way. Everybody with me on the Rambam so far? Who does the Rambam sound like he's talking about?
Lawyer.
How many people say lawyers? Good. Right now I'm just literally making you move because you've been sitting for a while. How many people say judges? Okay, it sounds like he's talking about third parties, and the third parties who are teaching some sort of set of arguments to a party, they sound like they might very well be lawyers. What's the Rambam worried about? What's the concern if these individuals assist one of the parties in terms of formulating their arguments? Okay, one option is maybe they're going to create an advantage. So if I help one party, well, that party now has an edge. Could we solve for that problem? Okay, so now we've got both parties. The Rambam still doesn't sound like he's on board. So what's bugging the Rambam, or at least on his interpretation of the Mishnah, what do we got?
It could be that by making him aware of what he would have to say in order to be successful, that you're kind of pushing him towards maybe not telling the truth.
Okay, good. So a gentleman from the audience suggests this. Your name?
Yoni.
Yoni says, here's the problem. And one of the problems is, of course, people may have different, there may be wealth disparities. Somebody can hire this guy, somebody can hire that guy. So maybe the problem is an equality problem. We want to make sure that both parties have the same assistance when they walk into, when they're in their preparation for court. Yoni says it's more fundamental than that even. This is kind of the intuition when people often criticize lawyers. The lawyer is going to provide some sort of set of advice or arguments to one of the parties, and he's going to nudge that party away from simply telling the truth when that party shows up before a particular judge. There's a way in which the lawyer functions to undermine justice in this context. Yeah?
As I'm sure you and many others here know, we study very much between the line between ethical coaching of clients and unethical coaching of clients. And prepare, what is ethical preparing of the client or witness to be on the witness stand, and how to present their testimony, and at what point are you planting ideas and words in their mouth. But I don't see any sort of those distinctions here.
Well, not yet. We're only on source number two. Give me a little bit of time. I promise model professional rules will show up on page something or another. We'll get there, I promise. But the counter-argument, of course, is that no, that's not fair to the lawyer. I suspect maybe I have an unsympathetic, or maybe a sympathetic room. Okay, I'm not going to actually prejudge that one. Maybe an unsympathetic room. What do you mean? That's not fair to describe the lawyers that way. Lawyers are constrained by a set of rules, and that's actually ultimately where we're going to head to in terms of talking about practical application of this set of rules in a based in context, actually talk about leveraging contemporary ethical rules regarding constraints on lawyers in order to create the type of justice system we're hoping to halakhically create. Okay, so we've got Yoni's concern right now. Yoni's concern about what it means, how exactly the lawyers are going to undermine justice in some way. What do you make then? Let's assume Yoni is right in terms of what the Rambam is thinking. Why would we even apply it in a set of circumstances where the third party knows who's right and wrong? So the third party is there, he knows. Somebody comes to him and he says, listen, I got this problem, and the attorney hears the case and he determines that it's obviously true that the person he's dealing with is telling the truth and the other person, that the counterparty, is a liar. If it's really all about promoting justice, so why wouldn't the Rambam then say, but I've got an idea, if it's in circumstances where you know the score, so then you should help them. Yeah?
He's taking over the role of the judge.
I'm sorry?
He's taking over the role of the judge.
What's first name?
Debbie.
So Debbie says, no, that's all well and good for you to say that this is all about justice, but do we really want the lawyer to be the one trying to figure out the answer? Why would that be a problem for the lawyer to do it when you say he's taking over the role of the judge? What's the issue? What's the problem?
The judge has certain constraints upon himself, and the judge is the one that's supposed to be non-partial and have all the different rules.
Well, he still would be non-partial. The lawyer simply knows who's right and wrong and therefore is going to assist that party in preparation before the judge. Why wouldn't that work? Yeah.
Hasn't heard from the other side that his interest is aligned because he's been working on that side. His interest is necessarily aligned with that side of the story.
Okay, so I take two arguments there. One of the first one is maybe he's in error for whatever reason. One reason might be because he hasn't heard the other party. He's certain he knows the story. I can tell you, somebody comes to me. Oh, this will be fun. I find basin work to be a challenging business. The reason is because invariably, 50% of your clients are unhappy with the result. That's a joke, you see, because somebody lost in the Din Torah. Okay, forget it. If you're at 50%, you're pretty good. When people tell me a story about Beis Din, I assume they're probably lying to me. And turns out that in my experience, people tell me lots of stories. When you start digging the facts, oh, it's a lot more complicated. So to hear from one party is all well and good. I'll tell you exactly what happened. Here's what happened. Here's what he did. Oh, my God, that person's terrible. You're so oppressed. Then you find out six more things, and you're like, wait a minute. You don't sound so oppressed anymore. And so maybe the Rambam's worry is you say ashuk me ashko, but you don't actually know that that's the case. So that's problem number one about putting this in the hand of a lawyer. What's problem number two? Problem number two is the incentives might be screwed up. Sometimes you're billing per hour, sometimes you're on contingency. It would be great for you to determine that this person is the one who is ashuk. He's oppressed, therefore I can start the clock and start billing him because I'm just helping the oppressed party. I'm the good guy. I happen to have a lot of money in my pockets right now, but I'm the good guy. You can see the Rambam's reluctance to maybe say we're going to have the determination of who is and is not ashuk in the hands of the third party making this determination. Okay, good. So the Rambam, so far what we have is we have a rule or an interpretation of the Mishnah from the Rambam. The Rambam says that we're talking about a third party, something akin to a lawyer who is preparing somebody to go before the judge. We have Yoni's interpretation of that. The problem is the preparation with the lawyer. What it is going to do is it's going to push the litigant to say things before the judge that aren't completely truthful, and as a result, the quality of the justice that will be dispensed by the judge ultimately will be impaired somehow, undermined, because the judge didn't really know the facts. One of the parties was nudged by an attorney to say something that was ever so slightly off base in terms of what actually happened. So far, so good? Okay, great. Parish number two. Let's go to the second Rishon. Here I have Rashi on the bottom. Rashi actually gives two interpretations of the Mishnah, one that is nearly identical to the Rambam. Rashi provides another interpretation of the Mishnah, and he says the following. Parish, shelo tigalel yachide dino. You shouldn't tell one party what the judgment is. Mishum shenemar shamo bein achichem u'shvatitzen tzedek. Shnehem ketzad. So how are you supposed to do it? You're supposed to do both of them at the same time. How does that work? Im ba'u shnayim lefanecha ledin v'tanu tanatam. Two people came before you and for a judgment, and they made their claims. Shetivarer hadin lehechan hunote, when you decide in which way the judgment leans, al tigale liachid adino, don't just tell one party what the rule is. Lo marlo acharecha hadin, to tell that party you're the one who's right. El lishneim biyachad tach lahen et hadin ulechayev et hachayav luzakot et hazakai. You should tell both of them at the same time who is the one who is has won, who's the one who lost, who is liable, who isn't liable. V'lo ta'aseh atzmecha ke'arkaos shel kutim. Don't make yourself like the courts of the kutim. Shelahem minag legalot et hadin liyachid mipnei hashochad. They would tell one party and not the other what the result was because of bribery. So let's start same analysis again. Does Rashi think the Mishnah is speaking to? Okay, so this sounds like he's speaking to judges. One can see, certainly it may not be as intuitive as the Rambam's view, or alternatively as Rashi's alternative view himself, Rashi adopting a second view of interpreting the Mishnah like the Rambam. Not quite as intuitive in the Orchei HaDayanim language. It sounds like the judges are the object of the Orchei HaDayanim, not the judges themselves, but one understands from the structure of the Mishnah why you might want to have an interpretation that sees this phrase also as speaking to judges. The Mishnah reads much better right now. All three phrases in the Mishnah speak to judges, three different instructions if you want to be a judge. And Rashi provides an option. Here's what he says. He says, Orchei HaDayanim, you shouldn't be one who in some way is arranging what's happening before you by telling one person what the outcome is and not the other. According to Rashi, what is the value? What's the thing we're worried about?
Bribery.
Or kind of bigger picture, what's the value at stake? Injustice. What kind of injustice?
Favoring one side.
Yeah, so the ultimate partiality of the judgment. There's no neutrality. We have a judgment that's biased. It's not that, like we talked about with respect to the Rambam, our worry is that the judgment is undermined or impaired because of lack of information or inaccurate information, but here the judgment is biased for a very different set of reasons, one that the judge can no longer be neutral, the judge is acting in a way that's not neutral, or even if the judge himself isn't in fact acting in a way that is partial to one party or the other, Rashi seems to say the instruction remains because it will be a perception of partiality. Right, Rashi says, don't be like the kutim who do this because of shochad. Sounds like we don't want to mimic shochad-like, bribery-like conduct, even, it sounds like, if judges are not acting in this way. Okay, so far we've got two views.
But why is, first of all, has Rashi as a word?
This is a great challenge. So the question is, how does Rashi read that into the words? And what I've suggested to you, it's tough to read Orchei HaDayanim that way, which is why I wanted to focus on the structure of the Mishnah, which is certainly Rashi in terms of the literal translation, and this is why Rashi does have two interpretations. Rashi in terms of the literal translation is a little more of a struggle, but in terms of the structure of the Mishnah, it reads much better. I can read that phrase better maybe if I interpret Orchei HaDayanim to refer to lawyers, but then it's an odd Mishnah, like who's the Mishnah speaking to? So one sees the kind of structural reasons to read it like Rashi, even if the words themselves are a little bit more complicated. Rashi doesn't give us so much of an inkling as to, I'm not sure if he's leaning on the word arkaos and orchei, I don't think so, but it's hard to, I think the question is the right question. I think the best response is to focus on the Mishnah structure. Okay, good, so we have two interpretations. So far we've got two interpretations of what Orchei HaDayanim might mean. I'm now gonna tell you a story. The story is just the Gemara. We're going to look at the Gemara, and we're going to try and figure out, it's going to be a third reference to Orchei HaDayanim, and the question is going to be, what does Orchei HaDayanim mean in the context of this Gemara? So turn the page 3 or page 41, source number 4. Okay, before, like every good story, not every, but like many good stories in the Gemara, first we have to learn some rules. So let's start. Tanu Rabbanan. Almana nizonet minichse yitomim. So a widow is maintained or receives support from the orphan's estate. Okay, so, and here we're talking about support. We're talking specifically, at least in the first line of the Gemara, with respect to food. And then the Gemara tells us the following. Utsricha refua harehi kimizonot. And it's also the case not only that the widow gets food from, or is supported with respect to things like food from the orphan's estate, Also, if tzricha refua, if she requires some sort of medical care, harehi kimizonot. We treat medical care just like we treat standard mizonot, standard food. So Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Meir, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, refua sheyesh la kitzva nitrapet miktubata. So now Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says there's kind of, well, the rule is a little bit more nuanced, he says. Refua sheyesh la kitzva, if there's some sort of kind of one-time or limited in time medical treatment, there she can't collect or she can't use money from the orphan's estate in order to pay for that medical treatment. That medical treatment comes out actually from her ksuba, from her own funds. She'ein la kitzva, if it's an ongoing medical treatment, harehi kimizonot. That's the circumstance where, if it's an ongoing medical treatment, we treat it like food. And you can see kind of the reason why food is an ongoing thing that we all need. We need food every day. If you have a medical treatment that looks in that way like food, so we say that's treated in terms of where the money comes from, like mizonot. So that comes from the orphan's estate. If it's a one-time, some sort of delimited medical treatment, that comes out of the widow's own money. Okay. And then Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Asu HaKazat Dam Be'eretz Yisrael, Kerefua She'en LaKitzva. This is just a side thing of how we treated bloodletting. Fortunately, not relevant for today. Okay. Krevi de Rabbi Yochanan, Havalu Isis Abba Dahavis Tzricha Refua Kol Yoma. So Rabbi Yochanan had some relatives. Here's the story. He's got some relatives, and they had a wife of their father. Turns out it's going to be a stepmother, that she required refua, she required medical treatment every single day. Asu l'kamei de Rabbi Yochanan. So they came before Rabbi Yochanan, and the implied question is they're not so happy because it's ongoing medical treatment, and who's going to have to pay the bill? It's going to come out of the orphan's estate. They are. So they come to Rabbi Yochanan, and they say the widow, their father's wife, they don't want to pay anymore. So they want Rabbi Yochanan to give them some sort of idea of how to avoid providing medical care for a widow. Oh dear. So Amar Lahu, Rabbi Yochanan says, I have an idea. Izilu kotzo le mide lerofe. Set up a, restructure the deal that you have with the doctor. And here's what you should do. You should just make it a one-time payment. Oh, this is brilliant, right? So we're going to make it a one-time payment to the doctor. Say to the doctor, we'd like you to give ongoing medical care to our stepmother, and we'll pay you a whole bunch of money just to tell us that forever, until she dies, you will provide the ongoing medical care. Why is that useful? Yeah, they figured out how to restructure the deal in order to avoid their own liability. This is fantastic work, and now Rabbi Yochanan has provided a way to avoid medical care for the widow. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, it sounds like, thinks about it a second time and says, Asinu atzmenu ke'orchei hadayanin. He laments and he says, I don't know, it's not quite in there, but oy vey, we've made ourselves like orchei hadayanin. So the Gemara is a little confused. They're like, if you feel bad about it, why'd you do it? So the Gemara says, Meikar my savar, levasof my savar. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you what he originally thought and what he thought in the end. Meikar savar umibsarcha altitz aleim. Ulivasov Savar Adam Chashushani. Initially, he thought the following. These are my relatives, so I have to help them out. I have a halachic obligation to assist my relatives. This is, by the way, how you know for certain that it's a stepmother, because otherwise he'd have relatives on both sides of the case. Okay, fine. So, Mibsarcha Altis Alein, and then Ulivasov Savar, he said, Adam Chashushani. This is not something that someone of my stature, Rabbi Yochanan, ought to be doing. Okay, here's the big question I'd like to answer. What does Orchei HaDayanin mean in this case? Is it more like Rambam or more like Rashi? Everybody with me on the question? Okay, so let's start with a show of hands, because you certainly all need to move at this point. How many people think this is more like Rambam? How many people think it's more like Rashi? Okay, I got a couple of... Let's get a... man in the suspenders over there, you said Rashi. Why do you think so?
Sure.
You're not sure. You like Rashi. I like Rashi too. He's a cool guy. You also said Rashi. Why?
Because in one sense he's telling one side that the judgment is in their favor. He's not, in a sense, judging for both parties equally.
OK, Okay, interesting. So one option over here is maybe he's like Rashi. So what was the value we set at stake with Rashi? So Rashi's core value, or at least in the version of the interpretation we looked at, Rashi is concerned about the appearance of partiality. And if that's the case, maybe in some way that's what we're worried about here. We have Rabbi Yochanan assisting one side, not the other side, and maybe that's somewhat Rashi-like. Anybody for Rambam that wants to put their hands up again? I forgot. Go ahead. Okay, so let's think about that for a second. How's he doing that? What was the Rambam value that we had before? The Rambam value we expressed earlier was, I'm going to tell one of the parties something, and what that's going to do is, as a result, they're not going to be faithful to the truth before the tribunal. They're going to tell the tribunal something else, and ultimately the judgment is therefore going to be impaired somehow. We're not going to get true justice if we allow these third parties to coach people before they go into court. Does that fit over here?
Well, the question is whether or not it's true justice that this woman is getting.
Why wouldn't it be true justice? He's not telling them what to say when they go into court.
No, he's telling them to tell the doctor. If they went to court, doing the doctor.
Well, they're telling a doctor, we have a new arrangement. No. What do you got?
It's a mistaken fact.
Okay.
The monetary thing, the payment, has nothing to do with what the deal was. The deal was, if you have ongoing treatment, it's one way. If it's a one-shot deal, it's another way. You can't change that by the way you pay.
So what you've said would be the bane of all restructuring lawyers' existences. That's for you, Benjamin. All they do all day is they move a little this, move a little there, they do that, they send somebody to the printer all night. That's all they do. They try to limit liability by restructuring the deal. And Rabbi Yochanan had an idea, a brilliant idea,
but
a maverick idea.
He could have been a payment.
So this is a legal question. Rabbi Yochanan appears to be wedded to a legal view also, a view of halacha. And the view of halacha is when we say yesh la kitzva or ein la kitzva, it doesn't just refer to the nature of the medical treatment, but it can also be delimited by the nature of the payment. That's his legal view. And then he married that legal view to a restructuring. I have a view about how halacha works. And then in addition to that, I have a suggestion for my nephews, and what I'm going to tell them to do is, in line with my legal view, just simply restructure the deal in keeping with halacha, and therefore you are no longer liable on my view of how halacha works. Now, we could contest. Somebody could contest. They could say, Rabbi Yochanan, you're wrong. That's not what yesh la kitzva or ein la kitzva means. And then ultimately you might litigate that. But what's Rabbi Yochanan worried about when he says, asinu atzmenu ke orchei hadayanim? What did we do wrong? What do we got over there?
From the doctor's perspective, you're now changing the doctor's interests because originally you insisted to treat the wound every time as often as possible, and now it's exactly the opposite. It's incentive to treat her as little as possible because you have one time payment.
So that certainly, to the extent you think that creates some sort of ethical problem for the doctor or maybe for those who are entering into an agreement, I can see that. Although the ethical problem doesn't sound like we would refer to it as asinu atzmenu ke orchei hadayanin, meaning disincentivizing medical care doesn't sound like what the Mishnah was talking about in Avos. Do you hear it? So we need to hang our hat on something. What do you got?
Asa mogen mogen shoda. Doctor who's paid nothing is worth what you're paying.
Okay.
Right, so to support this point over here, it's really perceived the relationship between his relatives and their stepmother as inverse to each other.
Okay.
And he was giving them a suggestion that was to her detriment ultimately.
Okay. I mean, that's fine. It certainly. So the suggestion is what? So the problem is that Rabbi Yochanan did something, the suggestion on the table. Your first name, I'm sorry?
Noah.
So Noah says, I'm reminded by the video to repeat what people are saying. So Noah says, no, the problem is that this third party, Rabbi Yochanan, he's acted in a way that has now undermined in some way the quality of the medical care received by the widow. And that is, why is that a problem? He's just restructured the deal in accordance with halacha.
He perceived Rashi actually on that.
Okay, good.
Looks like Rambam.
Oh, so, well, let's be clear before we jump to what we think everyone's saying. I want to be clear about what the values at stake are. I see Yoni's got his hand up again. What do you got?
I just wanted to point out that I don't think that the Rambam says don't be an Ora Dayan. He says mihi damos.
Okay.
To them.
Good.
So don't act in a similar manner. And in fact, you know, he says don't coach people to say such and such or something like that. So maybe it's a little broader than just being in a formal court setting in the Rambam. Also, because you're acting in a similar manner.
What's similar about it?
Manipulate the circumstances for your advantage.
Okay, so let's think about that for a second. So we're going to see the Rambam actually has a tremendous amount of flexibility in terms of what he means by Orchei Hadayanim. I also have a surprise ending to my talk. Okay, in any event. So let's think about this for a second. You said he's manipulating. What's the manipulation here? I want to make crystal clear. We're making an assumption. I'd love for somebody. Oh, here we go. Why is it manipulation?
Financially, he's taking away from the widow's principle.
What's your first name?
Malka.
So Malka says here's the issue. Halacha, in arranging its rules, clearly set out expectations for how this type of circumstance ought to go. And notwithstanding the formality with respect to what Rav Yochanan has arranged, he has moved out of alignment the halachic outcome from what halacha is aiming to achieve. That is, when he says asinu atzmenu ke'orchei hadayanim, he's conceding halacha has certain expectations about how you're going to treat a widow. This is intuitive to, I hope, every single one of us. And it's great that I was able to manipulate in some way the structure of the deal, but now I've moved that out of alignment. This is a very different value proposition than what the Rambam initially articulated. The Rambam was concerned. We're undermining justice. How? The judgment is not going to be based on a true set of facts. This is different. Here we now have an outcome. It's not what we haven't manipulated what's going on in court. We have an outcome that does not match with what halacha ultimately wants to achieve. It's a commitment not to a certain kind of judicial neutrality, but a substantive commitment about what halacha aims to achieve with respect to the vulnerable. And to that end, Rav Yochanan is concerned with what he's done. And then he has his ambivalence. He goes back and forth. But ultimately, what we have is almost a third set of values captured in the Orchei HaDayanim mantra, right? One is you don't want to undermine the nature, the value of the judgment, the degree to which it represents a true judgment. Number two, you don't want to act in a way that is tantamount to bribery. Number three is you don't want to use your ingenuity in order to undermine halacha's outcomes. One might even think of this, if I may be so bold. The Rambam initially describes the challenge with being a litigation attorney, and here the Gemara is describing the problem with a transactional attorney. Two very different types of concerns, both captured ultimately in this phrase. They're not mutually exclusive. They're just different ways to articulate the principle captured in the phrase in the Mishnah, Al Taz Asmecha Ko'orchei Hadayanim. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. So I don't think we're going to get into it in terms of time, although I'm happy if someone wants to tell me what time I'm supposed to finish.
You need 22 more minutes.
22 more minutes. Okay, so I think we're going to move a little bit faster. You'll notice some of the, well, let me just ever so quickly reference. I'll say, if you look at sources 6, 7, and 8, which we are not going to get to, I think 6, 7, and 8, you'll see there's a machloket over how to interpret the back and forth. What his ambivalence was, what does that mean, there are halachic implications to it, but we're just going to leave that aside. Let me simply just note, and if I recall, this diuk in the Rav Avadrami Bartanura is something I found in an article by Rabbi Reese who has explored this topic masterfully in a number of articles. Here, Rav Avadim Bartanura, when he interprets Altas Atzmecha Ko'orechei HaDayanim, the Rambam, when he phrased it, said, Emor Kach. Remember that phrase. Rav Avadim Bartanura, when he interprets the Mishnah, has an Asei Kach, which is certainly focused more on giving direction to people how to act prior to litigation, the restructuring, as opposed to the concern that the Rambam expressed in terms of providing arguments that are going to undermine the quality of justice. Okay, so far what we have is an awful story to be telling a group of lawyers, three really good reasons. I've covered litigation attorneys, transactional attorneys, judges, all the terrible things you might do if you are a third party trying to advise in some way on some sort of set of litigation. So turn to page 5. Let me try to start telling a better story. I hope you enjoyed the cartoon on top. I think it's hilarious. Shout out to Dov Emerson. Rabbi Dov Emerson, my brother-in-law, who sent this to me recently, said, you'll use this. And I said, yes, I will, because that's great. I never thought of power of attorney. Okay, great. So we're going to talk about power of attorney now. So the Mishnah itself, Altas Atzmecha Ko'orechei HaDayanim, the kind of line of reasoning from the Mishnah in Avos, that provides very good reasons not to be a lawyer. But that's not, those aren't all the sources we have. And here's an important series of sources based on the Gemara and Maseches Shavuos. So take a look for a second. Source number 9, page 5 of 43. Here we have a line from the Gemara and Maseches Shavuos. Vasher lo tov asa betoch amav. This is a pasuk from Yechezkel. He did that which is not good. Rav Amar, Rav says, what does that refer to? Zehaba Barsha. This is someone who comes with power of attorney. Somebody who in some way has... He has a stake in the litigation in some way. He has power of attorney. He is a Mursha. And somehow doing that, we're told by the Gemara, is Asher lo tov asa b'amav. He's doing something bad or problematic. Rashi explains in source number 10 why this is bad. Zahaba b'harsha. Mis'aber al riv lo lo. V'shem ha'risho noach lo v'noach l'pshar yoser mizeh she'enu yachal asos pshar b'mamon acherim. So, here's what Rashi says. Rashi says the problem is what's happening. You have given somebody power of attorney. To do that, they have some sort of stake in the litigation, so the opposing party can't say, la bal dvarim didiyat. They have a stake in your litigation. They show up in court. They're representing your interests and now their interests because they have a contingency interest or some sort of arrangement in your litigation. And as a result, they're going to litigate with the party, and the reason that this is bad is because Rashi says maybe the other party would be willing to, in some way, reach some sort of compromise. And the Mursha, the person who has power of attorney, he can't compromise because to do so, there's somebody else's interest at stake, and therefore we're going to have ongoing litigation. That's what Rashi says the problem, at least that's why this is Asher lo tov asa ba'amav, somebody who did that which is not good, because he's perpetuating litigation. But famously, Tosos gives kind of the flip side of this. So turn to page 6, source 44. Page 44, source 11. And here Tosos notes the following. Zaba baharshak she'ose bishvil shehu alam, hu bal tanos. This is when he does it because he's, quarrelsome. He loves to pick a fight. Shemis abar riv lo lo. And that's why he's getting involved. He wants to pick a fight, perpetuate litigation. Here, if somebody has power of attorney and they've taken on this role of power of attorney because they want to assist somebody in getting money that party doesn't have the ability to secure, one can imagine, we'll see in a moment, this was typically thought of in terms of geographic constraints. Travel was much more difficult. I have some sort of debtor in another town. I need somebody to go and be able to secure the money that I'm owed. There, when somebody is acting in that capacity with power of attorney, now they're doing, it's not that they're doing something bad, just the opposite. Tosos uses the language of mitzvah ka'avid. He's done something fantastic. He's done a mitzvah. And this is actually embodied in the Shulchan Aruch. Look at source number 12. Va'asher lo tov asa ba'amav zehaba beharshah. So here the Shulchan Aruch says, what does it mean? Why is it bad to be power of attorney? He says, that's when they're in one city. Aval im ha-nitva be'ir achas va-toveh be'ir acheres, the parties are in two different cities, ha-reza osa mitzvah. Then he's doing a mitzvah. This isn't some sort of technical thing. If you're in two cities, all of a sudden mitzvah appears. No, you're assisting somebody secure money that they're owed that they wouldn't be able to get on their own. And doing that is, in and of itself, we're told, a mitzvah. And here the Rama notes the following. V'yesh omrin de'ein chiluk bein im haya imo be'ir olo. It's not really whether or not you're in the same city or a different city. Ela shekol zman shahamursha hu alam uval tanos. Anytime, again, you're quarrelsome, that's why you've taken on this power of attorney. If that's the case, that's when we say you've done something wrong. V'sabra riv lo lo, you're getting involved in something. You're a thug. Aval im ose kede lahatzil ashuk me ashka. If you're doing it to help the oppressed from their oppression, mitzvah ka'avid. In those circumstances, when an attorney is acting in a way in order to assist somebody who is, they're in the right, and you're assisting them secure funds that they're owed or defending them from litigation where they are, in fact, ought not be held liable, here, under those circumstances, the Rama says, certainly, under those circumstances, you're doing a mitzvah. Now, here's the curiosity. So we have Ashuk Me Ashko. This reminds us of who? So this is where the Rambam said, interestingly enough. So here the Rama picks up the mitzvah ka'avid lahatzil ashuk me'ashko, which was precisely where the Rambam did not want to go. And we explored reasons why maybe the Rambam didn't want to go. The incentives are wrong. A variety of reasons why maybe we don't want to trust the attorney to decide who is the oppressor and who's the oppressed. But the Rama says if that's why you're doing it, that's how we view it. If those are the circumstances, then you're doing a mitzvah. You ought to do that, which raises the following question. Once the Rama takes kind of the baton from Tosfos and says, in these circumstances, mitzvah ka'avid, so what do we make of the Rambam? What was the Rambam's response to Ashuk Me'ashko? Oh, well, oppression. That's life. Seems like a little bit of a tough sell. And the truth is, to describe the Rambam that way would not be to view the entirety of the way in which he approaches this topic. So take a look at source number 13. Here, Rambam Hilchos Sanhedrin, Perek Chafalef Halacha Yudalef, notes the following. Ra'a hadayin zechus la'echad nech, uval din mevakesh la'amra. The judge sees that one of the parties, they have something that they ought to be saying in order to support their position. And the litigant is trying to say it. Ve'ene yodea l'chaber hadvarim. He just doesn't know how to put the words together right. Osha ra'ahu mitzar l'hatzil atzma betanas emes. He sees somebody who's got something, he knows it's the truth, and the guy just, he can't quite get there. Umpnei hachema v'hakas nistalik mimenu. Maybe he's just too angry to be able to express this clearly. O nishtabesh mipnei hasichlus. Or he lacks the intellectual capacity to make the argument. The judge is allowed to ever so gently help this litigant in order to get on the right track with the argument. Because, this is the famous phrase, you're supposed to open the mouth, so to speak, of the mute person. And here's how the Rambam ends. Utsarach lehisyashev bedavar zeharbe shelo yehiyeh keorchei hadayanim. The judge has to be super careful in order to make sure he doesn't make himself like one of the orchei hadayanim. You see, it's interesting. The Rambam originally, when we looked at him, it sounded like he was talking to lawyers. And we said, oh, how does that fit with the structure of the mission and all the other stuff? But when you look at the Rambam's complete view, it's a admonition that applies equally both to lawyers and to judges, to anyone involved in the case in any way. That if you in some way assist somebody too much, you then may be undermining justice in the ways we've described. But the Rambam is willing to take a risk. He's willing to say, in cases of, one assumes, ashuk me ashko, right? He's trying to tell the truth, he just doesn't know quite how to get there. There the Rambam says, the Rambam's response isn't that we leave the oppressed on the side, but the person I want assisting him is not the lawyer, but the judge. And when you think about it this way, you realize at its core what we have is a machlokas over institutional design. And given that I just said institutional design. The code word is institutional. Yes. That's going to be annoying for someone. Okay, good. It's a machlokas over institutional design. We have, what do we have? We have a legal system. And in the legal system, there are two parties. And in various circumstances, one party is going to have advantages over the other. And as a legal system, we need to solve that problem. So what do we use to solve the problem? The dominant view, going from the language of the Gemara and Shavuos, Tosfos, Shulchan Aruch, Rama, is we like to use third parties. And you can see the advantages of using a third party. Listen, they're on the outside. They're just going to help. They're helping as best they can to get the right outcome because somebody just may not have the skills, talents, ability. They may be too angry in order to do it themselves. And so that's why we allow somebody to assist them under those circumstances, not to be quarrelsome, not to just foment further litigation, but for the right motivations, that's how we want to deal with the problem. And the Rambam says, no, no, no. Given the choice between a third party kind of meddling in the affairs or a judge trying to level the playing field, I'll pick the judge. Now, we say to the Rambam, a little bit of a challenge here. We probably all feel it when we read the Rambam. You're going to have the judge do that? Is this neutral anymore? You're helping one party as the judge. The Rambam says, I'll take a little bit of maybe partiality from the judge over the meddling of an attorney. And on the flip side, the other Mefarshim say, no, I'll take a little bit of meddling from an attorney before I'll take a little bit of partiality from a judge. Somebody's going to have to help in order to level the playing field. And different Mefarshim, Poskim, Rishonim, Achronim have an institutional design question. What's the best way to solve for this problem? Because we're not going to leave. We have to help Ashuk Me'ashko. There's no alternative. That's not a legal system we're willing to endorse where there's simply no way to assist that person. We simply have a debate over who the right person ought to be. Now, yeah.
But going back to Pirkei Avot, it says that the judge is supposed to, or somebody is supposed to look at both people in front of them as if they're guilty.
Yeah.
So you would presume that they're not really going to get the disadvantaged person to get to the truth because...
Yeah, so...
How do you deal with that?
Clearly the Rambam is of the following view. I mean... You look at them and you assume the baseline is you treat everybody and you interrogate them as if they are Rishayim. But the Rambam's also willing to authorize the judge and say if you see some sort of grave injustice where one party is struggling for reasons of intellectual capacity, a variety of things, they're simply too angry. Even with all of that at stake, we need some sort of safety valve because otherwise, if we don't have a safety valve when there are these forms of inequality, so then the judgment's undermined in and of itself. And that's the choice the Rambam makes. A completely legitimate choice, obviously. Not the one that we ultimately follow when we use the Rama, although to some extent judges and Dayanim still have some flexibility in this area. We leverage lawyers, and I'm going to say something about that, but that's the approach that the Rambam took to the issue. Not willing to let a third party, even Ashuk Me'ashko, as opposed to someone like the Rama, who's certainly far more willing based on Tosos, based on the Gemara. So, well, I see a lot of questions, but I am pretty confident I have
7 minutes.
Eight minutes. Okay, so let me say something about how implementing this approach. What's the core proposition of this kind of approach to the question we're dealing with? So, what we want is, we want to take the good from the lawyer without the bad from the lawyer. That's the simplest way to describe it. Lawyer has the capacity to be mitzvah ka'avid and also to foment unnecessary litigation. What's a structure or a system? If that's your underlying premise, how do you build something like that? So here we have both, I would say, challenges and opportunities from the hand we're dealt by American law. So on the one hand, American law has a variety of ethical obligations imposed on lawyers. Many of you know these all quite well. I put two of them on up top on page 7, sources 14 and 15. These are from the Model Rules of Professional Responsibility. New York has pretty much analogous rules for both these propositions. On the one hand, when representing a client, a lawyer shall exercise independent professional judgment and render candid advice. In rendering advice, a lawyer may refer not only to law, but other considerations such as moral, economic, social, and political factors that may be relevant to the client's situation. On the one hand, a lawyer is able to incorporate all these sorts of principles into the advice that they provide. Also, a lawyer shall not bring or defend a proceeding or assert or controvert an issue therein unless there is a basis in law and fact for doing so that is not frivolous, which includes a good faith argument for an extension, modification, or reversal of existing law. Here, a lawyer is not just supposed to be fomenting litigation in the way the alam, the baal tanos of the of halacha, the way in which we describe them. So both the model rules and halacha have this instinct that we don't want attorneys simply fomenting frivolous forms of litigation. So the lawyer, the American lawyer, we have some expectations and, as a result, constraints on him. One I didn't put in here is also candor to the tribunal. They have an obligation to tell any tribunal, whether it's an arbitration panel or a court, they have to tell the truth, to lie, to obfuscate in ways that are intentional in order to hide the ball and hide the facts and hide the law also represents an ethical violation. And so on the one hand, the lawyer, we've got some constraints on them. At the same time, we also have an obligation under New York law, and I have probably no jurisdiction comes to mind right now that doesn't have this rule. We have an obligation to allow parties before a beis din in order to bring an attorney with them. If you want to, the New York site is CPLR 7506. This is a non-waivable right, representation by attorney. A party has the right to be represented by an attorney and may claim such a right at any time as to any part of the arbitration or hearings which have not taken place. This right may not be waived if a party is represented by an attorney. Papers to be served on the party shall be served upon his attorney. Everybody who shows up in arbitration, and the basin, as you've heard already, functions as an arbitration tribunal, every party has a right to an attorney, and it's actually much more than that. If you look at Kahn v. Rosner, 2009, New York Supreme decision, there you had a basin that had a provision in their agreement that said that any attorney you bring with you has to be approved by the beis din. Here you can look at it on the first paragraph. We also accepted upon ourselves to bring along only such rabbinical counsel as acceptable to the rabbinical court. And if we appear at the rabbinical court without rabbinical counsel, we do so by our own desire. If you read the facts of the case, the rabbinical tribunal, the beis din sees somebody that's brought to them and says, we don't like that person, bring somebody else. And ultimately the party continues without representation by counsel. New York Supreme decision, that not only is it a violation of CPLR 7506 to tell somebody that they can't bring an attorney at all, it's also a violation to say that they can't bring the attorney of their choice. That's extraordinary because that's a non-waivable right. It's not just that I can't waive my right to an attorney, I can't waive my right to supervision by the tribunal to decide which attorney I can bring. So on the one hand, the beis din functioning under New York state law has the constraint. It must allow parties to bring an attorney. On the other hand, that's actually not so bad because an attorney, a real attorney before you, has constraints on them. They have to tell the truth. They can't lie to you. They can't foment frivolous litigation. They can advise based on a variety of axes like economics, moral, one would even say religious. And attorneys actually serve in that way as maybe an opportunity, the law, the way it's structured, is an opportunity to get the good without the bad. What does the bad look like? Forgive me. The bad looks like people who want to represent parties in front of a beis din who are unlicensed. Sometimes we call them tohanim. And these are rabbinic counselors who have no licensing in any which way. They show up. And their job, as best I can tell, most of the time is to foment frivolous litigation because they bill by the hour. And if that's true, well, what do you do to the tohen when they show up? Nothing, because there are no ethical obligations that you can impose upon them to stop them from somehow obfuscating and preventing some sort of true judgment. An attorney who engages in that conduct, I can tell you exactly what you do. You call up the American Bar Association, you call up the New York Bar, and you say, this guy's a liar, and you need to take away his license. Lawyers have the ability to advise based on all the criteria we like. They're required to come. And if they act in a way that undermines our objectives of justice, we have a way to keep them in check. And in this way, using attorneys is kind of the fulcrum. American law, 21st century attorneys in front of a beis din, aligns us in a certain way, capturing that core intuition of mitzvah ka'avid, identifying people who can assist parties and level the playing field, ultimately with the objective of ensuring that the quality of justice is enhanced. Okay. Oh, if you want to get a flavor for the actual rules of the Beit Din of America that capture this, take a look on page 8. This is rules, and from our rules and procedures, sections 12 and 13. Any party shall have the right to be represented by an attorney who must be licensed, and of course that's the way we get them. And then on section 13, all proceedings of the Beit Din shall be private, unless the jurisdiction provides to the contrary. And here we note that you can bring an attorney with you, but you can't just bring anybody with you. And as a result, we're able to ensure that the people who are there assisting parties in order to make sure that they have the right arguments to make, that they're not too angry, or they have the skills necessary in order to give a full and fair statement of their claims before the Beit Din, we make sure those people actually are accountable, not only to their parties, but also to the Beit Din, and ultimately to the halachic form of justice we are trying to advance. I think I'm running out of time, so I'm feeling a little bit bad about this, but I think we're having questions and answers after this. Let me just conclude with a couple of ever so quick thoughts. More minutes? None? I'm out?
You're good.
I'm good. Okay, great. I promised you at the outset that I was going to try to describe to you the way in which we are building, or the Beit Din system is meant to promote certain halachic values. And I tried to identify for you how the debate over lawyers, to have lawyers, third parties, in a Beit Din system is about, it's not just a legal technical rule, it's about competing values. How do we balance the needs of equality before the law with neutrality of the law? And we have a dispute. How do we build institutions? What's the institutional design to make sure that everyone has what they need in order to get justice? Maybe we'll take a little bit from the judge, maybe we'll take a little bit from third-party lawyers, and then we'll build a system where everybody is accountable in the way in which they're assisting parties so that the ultimate judgment achieves justice. Here's what I want to emphasize. We do not approach, from the perspective of halacha, the question of, do I have a right to an attorney, as a way to merely maximize the outcomes for the parties. What we're trying to answer when we view this question in the halachic legal system is, how do we maximize the goals of Jewish justice? Because we need a system where each person is able to have their claims heard and has the infrastructure necessary so that those claims heard are accurately and in their best light. This is a vital distinction. This is what, in many ways, I hope, differentiates our legal system, certainly differentiates the work that we try to do at the Beit Din of America. Our work, ultimately, I have the pleasure. I get calls all the time, and it's a just genuine pleasure to work with the professionals because of what the ultimate objective is. The ultimate objective is, how do we incorporate equity and justice into a Beit Din legal system? How do we, it's ultimately about promoting God's values in terms of navigating our most difficult moments. When we are in these types of disputes, are we able to elevate them and say that ultimately the values of justice and equity, the ones captured in halacha, are what's going to organize how we deal with each other? I said this yesterday, and I'll say it again today, we can certainly do a lot better job within our community of pursuing these objectives. And I mentioned yesterday, and I'm going to, for those of you who heard it, I don't get tired of saying this. Makes me quite sad, but I think it's something we have to express. So there's this Nishma research that conducted a survey in 2017, and they said that they asked people, what are the biggest issues facing the Jewish community? And over 50% of people surveyed said one of the biggest problems is that people are dishonest in business. This is like our number four issue. Like, over half of us think this is a problem. And Beit Din justice is meant to address this. It's the institutional arm of our community that is particularly specifically built to provide justice when we have these types of problems. Too many of us, when we hear Beit Din, we decide that's not for us. We'll go to court, we understand it better, it's easier, I know what to do. And we don't leverage our heritage of Jewish justice, which is, you know, astonishing to me. Part of the problem is an educational problem. We don't quite know enough about the Beit Din system. We don't know the rules well enough. We don't know the procedure well enough. And days like this are meant to kind of pull back the veil and express that it's pretty straightforward. And it's not just that it's straightforward, but that it's governed not by the formalities of how we structure a deal, but by our attempts to implement God's law and God's dominion on this earth. We need to do a better job educating ourselves. It should be part of our day school curricula. We should have more days where we have adult education addressing these issues. We need to do a better job so that our perception of ourselves as a people who have maybe lost their way a little bit in how we deal with each other when it comes to commerce, that we leverage the institutions baked into the core of our Misora, we leverage those institutions to do a better job. I'm gratified to be here both yesterday and today to share this all with you, and I hope we take advantage of these opportunities to do much, much better going forward.